Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall.
Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. As the election winds to a close, it feels like there are few areas of agreement between President Barack Obama and former Governor Mitt Romney, and between Democrats and Republicans in general. But here's one. We want innovation to grow new businesses. Now, that could be part of anybody's stump speech. So today, we're going to get beyond the platitudes and ask, no matter who becomes president, how do you foster innovation? How do you ensure that America is a rising power at the forefront of cutting-edge technology and not lagging behind? And joining me are Rosabeth Moss Cantor, professor at Harvard Business School and author of Supercorp, How Vanguard Companies Create Innovation, Profits, Growth, and Social Good, and Bhaskar Chakravarti, a dean at Tufts Fletcher School. Thanks very much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Thank you, Kara. Good to be here.
So, Rosabeth, let me start with you here. I wonder, when it comes to the idea of fostering innovation, have you heard any really good solution so far in the campaign?
I think there is a big difference between the candidates in the campaign because innovation requires great education, and it also does require some sources of funding for ideas and technologies that may not have immediate commercial payoff, which means the federal government. Well, hey, now there's a difference between the two candidates. Even though Governor Romney was governor in a state that thrives because of federal research funding, I mean, if that goes, we have problems in this region in terms of the ability to create jobs because those technologies ultimately result in commercializable technologies that are coming out of the universities, et cetera. So we must continue that. That means also, of course, encouraging the entrepreneurial spirit and encouraging startups. But startups are thriving because the basic research ideas are there.
It's interesting because when you listen to Governor Romney's campaign speeches, you do hear Massachusetts cited sometimes, and very often it is in the areas of jobs and education where we are below the unemployment rate nationally, we're doing better, and very often number one in education, which he often does mention, but you feel like he's leaving something out.
Well, the federal government role. I mean, first of all, Massachusetts also in its education reforms had certainly they took place at the state level, and some of them took place under earlier administrations in Massachusetts. But we also have a Race to the Top grant. This is one of the most positive things the Obama administration has done. This is actually an area they would agree on kinds of solutions that involve fostering excellence by competitive processes, but it's actually the Obama administration that has given grants on a competitive basis based on your reforms and how well you're doing, and Massachusetts has benefited from that. But that's K through 12. It's our higher education system, which is heavily dependent on the federal government. And so that education and those jobs don't spring from nowhere, I guess is what I'm saying. There's a foundation behind them. Even Silicon Valley, our great rival in this region, Silicon Valley benefited from Defense Department spending, something that got conveniently forgotten by a lot of entrepreneurs later who said, oh, we did it all by ourselves. But a lot of the initial technologies, including the internet, came because the Department of Defense had a stake for national security reasons in getting the best and the latest technologies.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bhaskar Chakravarti, speak to that. I mean, obviously, when we look at what are our most successful companies and we think about Google and Apple, companies that have not just transformed America, not just transformed what we buy, transformed what the world wants and what the world buys. These are obviously private entities. What's been the government role there?
I would completely agree with Rosabeth's point, which is that the government's role has been to make those fundamental investments in technologies that essentially created the foundations on top of which the entrepreneurs, the new ventures have built, you know, fantastic companies, the Googles and the Apples. And practically every single fantastic company that you can name is built on one such foundation. And we could spend this entire radio program just citing the list. I mean, just from the perspective of Massachusetts, the president that we in Massachusetts should be thanking the most, and this is going to come as a shock to a lot of our listeners, is Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon diverted a fair amount of federal money towards biomedical research. Essentially, there was biological weapons research that was being done by the Defense Department, and he decided to put federal money into using the outcomes of those research towards biomedical applications, which then essentially spawned the foundations of what we see as the Boston core strength in bio. On the flip side, when we kind of look at the current campaign and both sides of the campaign mouth the word innovation as if it's, you know, it's like personal hygiene, flossing your teeth. It's kind of good to do. But how many of us actually go back and floss our teeth every time we're supposed to? When you look at the details, it seems like certainly the Republican plan indicates that there is going to be some severe cuts in that foundational investment. About a quarter of the budget in non-defense expenditures in science and technology and biomedicine is going to be cut. About two-thirds of the research on energy, alternative energy investment, is planned to be cut, according to what one sees or reads between the lines in the Republican plan, which is actually very, very worrying.
So the question, Rosabeth, is then why is neither campaign talking about this? You don't hear President Obama saying, look, I would give a lot of money to the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. And actually, let me play a little clip for you. I recently talked to Art Kaplan, who was at UPenn for many years and now is at NYU Langone Medical Center. And he talked about the important role of the government in funding research. And in his case, it's really basic medical research. Let's listen.
It's crucial, vital. I think people don't understand sometimes because they see big companies ranging from Microsoft and Google to the Mercks and the Pfizers and the Glaxos, and they think, well, why do we have to put any of our tax money, government money, into these activities? The answer is companies, private companies, are not going to spend money on basic research, on fundamental foundational research, because it takes too long to pay off. And it often doesn't pay off. It's kind of a gamble as to whether you're going to get a drug or a practical application or a new software program when you're just starting out in the lab or at the bench or even at a desk. Government has to pay for that as a kind of public good or common good. If we're going to get the results of doing the most foundational basic research, you can't go to the marketplace. They're waiting for products that they can sell easily and that are very close to, if you will, being ready to go to market.
Rosabeth Kanter from Harvard Business School, how does that argument resonate with you?
Well, it resonates very well with me. I think that's exactly the foundation of our success in Massachusetts and in America. I mean, America has thrived because we've been the source of ideas in a foundational way that have kept companies here, have grown companies here, have created products that can be sold at a premium on world markets, and that has kept us ahead. I mean, we are actually in jeopardy of not being so ahead in a lot of those technologies anymore. And as for why this hasn't been stressed by the Obama campaign in particular, which has been presiding over some very good policies, including trying to get some of the basic funding commercialized faster. That's a new criteria, not to be too jargony here, but at DARPA, a new criteria is that they not only give grants for some great basic research, but also they want to know that it has commercial potential. That's under the Commerce Department in an Obama administration. Every state knows this, and many governors are talking about it. And if our Governor Patrick has the ear of the president, as he does, I'm sure he's talking about this is why we have low unemployment relatively in Massachusetts or recovered quickly. And governors know that, and mayors also want that innovation. But right now in this sort of anti-tax cutting government, the deficit, this seems like, well, we're piling up debt by investing in something that won't pay off immediately. I don't happen to think that's true. We can get into that later, but I think that's one of the reasons you may not hear much about it. This is a longer-term investment. This is not something that we'll get tomorrow. President Obama's Jobs Council was just here visiting, and one of the interesting things was they did some really good things to boost the economy. They were tiny things. They had to back away from any of the big things like an infrastructure bank, even though, of course, we know that our infrastructure is vulnerable. We've just seen that with Sandy in a horrible way.
Absolutely.
But they did some short-term things like they speeded up the process by which foreigners could get tourist visas in the U.S., which meant more people could come as tourists and spend money in the U.S. Okay, that's a little boost to the economy. Short term, tiny. This kind of innovation spending is longer term.
I think that there are two issues that virtually most of the electorate would agree on in terms of what the government's role is. One is getting jobs back. And to Roosevelt's point, you know, that is the single biggest pain point across the economy, other than the devastation associated with Superstorm Sandy. But, you know, the secular problem is that of jobs. And investments in these kind of foundational innovations and foundational technologies do not bring back the kind of volumes of jobs in the near term. So that's one reason why that's being de-emphasized by both campaigns. Second is that most of the electorate agrees that the role of the government is defending ourselves against the quote-unquote enemy, whoever the enemy happens to be, in a real or an imagined war. Historically, every major innovation, all the ones we're talking about, were at some point a spillover from a defense expenditure, starting with George Washington, who invested interchangeable parts, which contributed to rifles, to Lincoln, who invested in railroads, which played a role in the Civil War, to Eisenhower and nuclear power, to Richard Nixon in biological weapons, and more recently, all the investments in wireless technologies and the internet. The core of it was war spending. And right now, our quote-unquote war is against a bugbear called China. And I think neither campaign is putting its finger on where the real conflict point with China is. I mean, there's a political issue, but there's also an issue of sort of winning market share and mind share across the global economy with China, which is where we need to bring back the discussion.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH. We're talking about innovation and politics with Rosabeth Moss-Cantor, professor at Harvard Business School, and Bhaskar Chakravarti, senior associate dean at Tufts Fletcher School. And let me come back to that issue of China. That has certainly been an issue in the campaign, that question of China and how are we doing, and this, I think, real anxiety about are we falling behind. Is your sense in the next war, if the next war is really a war over talent and innovation, are we falling behind?
That's a really interesting question, and it's a question that can lead to at least multiple opposing answers. So on the one hand, I would argue that we are not falling behind for the simple reason that the United States has the foundations of being the most open, the most creative, the most sort of free-form society and economy in the world. And I don't see the fundamentals of that changing, despite all our concerns about, you know, where we are as a country, as an economy. At the same time, I do see China going down the path that the United States has gone down 40, 50, 60, 70 years back. And second, on the question of education, China is definitely investing a lot more in the so-called STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and we are falling behind. We are falling behind, and over the long term, that is going to hurt us.
I want to get to education in a minute, but you visit China frequently. Tell me, and Rosabeth too, so I'm going to ask each of you, but Bhaskar first, when you visit China, do you worry? Do you look around and think, whoa, you know, Americans have no idea the kind of infrastructure that China is building up, or do you think, I don't think we have too much to worry about yet?
I certainly worry because, you know, China is not just one country. It is an enormously complex country, and there are layers within layers. And you can see the glittering towers of Shanghai and get really depressed because, they, you know, Boston or New York or San Francisco doesn't come anywhere close. But at the same time, you know, China has its challenges, and there is too much rigidity in the system, not just in the educational system, but also there's a very top-down approach to the whole process of innovation and entrepreneurship. But simultaneously, I would not write off China's ability to innovate, because fundamentally, if that government continues to provide the framework, it's an extremely pragmatic government. It continues to learn and it continues to adapt. It continues to provide the framework and give enough freedom for the capitalist system to grow on top of that. And eventually, many of these Chinese companies, which are primarily imitators or pirates, will become innovators. And imitation is very often the first step towards innovation. In fact, the word Yankee originated from a Dutch word for piracy.
Rosabeth Cantor, when you look at China and you look at the issues in the campaign and this concern over China, do you worry that we're being left behind?
There was a bestseller in Harvard. China, I gave away the punchline, which was called Harvard Girl. And it was all about ambitious parents who wanted to make sure that their kids got into Harvard. So one of our ways of competing is to continue to strengthen our educational institutions here and then keep the people who come here to study. So one easy thing that can be done, and that, again, I know the Obama administration has talked about, the Romney campaign has been very equivocal about immigration and immigration reform, except promising something vague. We should create the visa program that stamps a green card to every graduation certificate, every diploma of everybody who's studying here, and keep that talent in the United States, and then see China as it evolves from cheap contract manufacturing to sophisticated technology. Keep it as a partner where we can sell them things and we can also learn from that partner. And so if we would de-escalate the rhetoric, which is definitely campaign rhetoric, and of course there are some things we should stand up for, like protecting intellectual property, and those Chinese companies will never be world players until they get a greater sense of accountability, transparency, and responsibility. And that's already a movement starting to grow in China a little bit.
So I want to go to the question then of education, which we touched on. And I talked a few months ago to Michael Greenlee, who's a venture capitalist right here in Boston, and he was talking about the problem that he sees in education in the U.S.
And if our higher education systems are choosing to educate foreign students, the tragedy is that we don't, as it by policy, allow them to stay and be productive. So I know when I talk to the CEOs that we back as venture capitalists, they salivate over looking at the talent pools coming out of MIT and Harvard and some of the other academic institutions. But those students aren't able to stay.
Bhaskar Chakravarti from Tufts, I mean, if you're looking at this problem from a business point of view, from a creating more jobs point of view, why aren't both, you know, President Obama and Mitt Romney saying, here are green cards, let's staple them to your PhDs?
It goes back to what wins elections. What wins elections are large numbers of jobs that affect that mythical middle class. And the PhDs who are coming out of the elite institutions, it's not just the PhDs, people with advanced degrees or people with degrees in, you know, some of the hard sciences and technologies, they are still part of an elite. And the election rhetoric is aimed towards a somewhat different audience. And that audience is really concerned about what immigration, particularly immigration from south of the U.S. border, might be doing to their jobs and might be doing to the wage rates in this country.
Is there any proof that those people, that those high-skilled immigrants do help create real jobs, real people?
Oh, absolutely. These are the same people who go off and start companies. More than 50% of startups in Silicon Valley and elsewhere have been started up by immigrants and people often with H-1B visas. And those companies, several of them, become massive, massive job creators. So absolutely, these are the seeds that will eventually kind of grow into the giant trees that generate a lot of fruit.
Roosevelt Cantor.
Absolutely. And by the way, I think this has come up in the campaign. I think it's drowned out. But I think, again, President Obama has talked about this, stands for it, has tried to get it through. And, of course, the high-skilled immigration are not the only immigrants who come and create jobs. So do the lower-skilled who are looking for a better life for their kids. And this issue of keeping the children of illegal immigrants who graduate from college in the U.S., that's another really good one because these are hardworking people. You know, not every individual with skill creates a job for somebody else, but you need those people to go to work in the companies that are the innovators of the future. But in addition, there is a way in which massive quantities of jobs are being created in the swing states because of innovation and technology. And that is in part the auto industry, which is a big consumer of new technology, whether we're talking about green or electronics in cars. This is big. And so that brings us to the other education problem, which is how we get the people who don't necessarily need a four-year degree. We have at least, the estimates vary, but at least 3 million unfilled jobs in the United States, jobs that exist because companies cannot find people with these so-called middle skills. And some of it is manufacturing skills. It might also be lab technicians. And so we are not educating people for those middle skills. Often that's community college.
So we have an education
gap. We have an education gap. And there is work going on around it. And that's very important to Governor Patrick. There's work going on in this region. So we need to work on education at every level. And immigration reform is only part of that. I mean, all of us sitting here probably came from someplace else. And it was because, and I'm sure that my ancestors were not embraced happily either in the beginning, but now here I am, a Harvard Business School professor.
And Bhaskar Chakravarti, feel free to comment on that. Yeah. But also, I know you've talked to me before about coming here from India decades ago and how not that much has changed in the ease of immigrating.
It is incredibly difficult for smart people from anywhere in the world to come to the United States. You have to jump through so many hoops, and these hoops are largely ridiculous. I came to the United States 30 years back, and the conversation that I had with the immigration officer at the U.S. Embassy was ludicrous. He knew that I was making it up, and I knew that I was making it up, which is I was giving him all the reasons why I was going to go back to India as soon as I had finished my PhD in the United States. And the kinds of arguments you were expected to give was, my family owns an ancestral home in some village somewhere where we have cows and other forms of agricultural assets that I need to go back to. Apparently, that same ludicrous conversation happens even today. And now the problem has become even more difficult for the students who are planning to come to the United States today because of the post 9/11 situation where, you know, everybody is a potential suspect. And of course, people from different parts of the world are treated differently. And basically, these people, they're so motivated to come to the United States. These are exactly the people you would want. Because they can overcome all kinds of obstacles.
Let's deal with one other question here, the issue of the business community. And you certainly hear a lot of people on Wall Street concerned about taxes and regulation. Here's Mitt Romney talking to the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in September about government intervention.
Now, I happen to believe that entrepreneurs are the future for America. I believe the credit for their work goes to them, not to the government. And I sure don't believe that the government should take more of what they earn away from them. This is really at the heart of the difference between President Obama and my vision for the future of America's economy. He wants government to tax more and regulate more because he believes government can do a better job than you can.
Elizabeth Cantor from Harvard Business School. Isn't there some truth to the fact that businesses have not had a great relationship with the Obama administration?
No one loves taxes, but people do understand something about the common good, the common interest, and the role of the public sector. And we're not going to privatize absolutely everything, and we see what happens when we're not prepared. But, you know, business community differs. I mean, entrepreneurs basically want to be left alone. But it's also not small business per se that builds the future, because a lot of people start companies not because they want to be small, but because they want to get big. It's startups with a big idea that build the future.
Bhaskar Chakravarti from Tufts, you do, though, have a candidate who really does no business and has been a turnaround guy in the middle of a tough economic climate. There's an interesting dovetail there with the idea of innovation and bringing the country back.
I don't believe that competence in turning around a struggling business necessarily translates into competence in regrowing a struggling economy, because there are many, many differences, and not the least of which being that a turnaround situation necessarily requires you to start with a relatively close-in time horizon. You have a certain period of time within which you need to create value and put a company back onto the market. And you very often have to ignore a variety of externalities. You have to ignore rules and regulations and so on in many situations. To Rosebud's point, the two things that bite the most in terms of the relationship between politics and business is taxes and regulations. We definitely need taxes, and the question of taxes comes down to corporate taxes and individual taxes, and they both bite. There's a lot of concern about executive pay and the fact that certain classes of people get to pay only 13 to 15% of their incomes, whereas others pay upwards of 40%. So that's an issue. Corporate taxes, certainly a concern where people are going to differ. Regulations, We are worried about regulations in compounding factories in Massachusetts. We are worried about regulations in regulating the financial services industry, which essentially brought this entire economy to a point of collapse. And granted that the Dodd-Frank and other kind of follow-up to that whole disaster isn't perfect, but throwing the baby out with the bathwater is not a solution either. It is just going to bring us right back to the brink of the same disastrous events that led up to 2007, 2008.
A really interesting conversation. I think we could go on for another half an hour about how politics and innovation intersect. I've been speaking with Rosabeth Moss Kanter, professor at Harvard Business School and author of Supercorp, How Vanguard Companies Create Innovation, Profits, Growth, and Social Good, and Bhaskar Chakravarti, senior associate dean at Tufts Fletcher School. Thanks to both of you so much for coming in and joining us.
Thank you, Kara.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here with Rosabeth as well.
And thank you for joining us this hour. You can find our podcasts on iTunes or at wgbh.org/innovationhub. And you can follow me on Twitter at Kara E. Miller. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub. Last for the time.